Democracy died in Mexico shortly before midnight on February 22, 1913. Or to be more precise, it was assassinated, almost certainly on orders from a traitorous general named Victoriano Huerta, and almost certainly with the tacit permission of the U.S. Ambassador Henry Lane Wilson. Democracy had a name, an apostle according to supporters. That name was Francisco Ignacio Madero González. Madero was 39 years old, and he had been in office for just 15 troubled months. He would be the first and last democratically elected Mexican president of the 20th century. According to newspaper reporters who had gathered outside the National Palace in downtown Mexico City that evening, sometime around 11:15 p.m., a dozen soldiers under the command of a Major Francisco Cárdenas had loaded Madero and his vice president, José María Pino Suárez, into two cars, a black Proto sedan and a gray Packard, and had driven them to La Cumbre prison, allegedly for their own protection. The penitentiary was just under 2 miles away. The first reporters on the scene, out of breath from a hot pursuit on foot, heard the sound of gunshots coming from behind the building. A minute or so later, still running, they turned the corner to find the dead bodies of the two prisoners propped up in the cars and a group of soldiers and policemen milling around awaiting further orders. Major Cárdenas informed the reporters that the escort had been attacked by an armed group of Madero supporters, that the prisoners had fled in an attempt to join their rescuers, and that they had been killed in the crossfire. General Huerta, who had assumed the presidency a few days earlier, expressed outrage and promised a full investigation. Major Cárdenas was detained for questioning, but soon released and promoted to lieutenant colonel. The democratic aspirations of the Mexican people, who had elected Madero by an overwhelming majority, had suffered a fatal blow, or so it seemed. Before his election, Madero had been a brilliant political strategist. His unexpected gifts as a propagandist and his remarkable ability to forge alliances across seemingly unbridgeable divides had proven instrumental in the overthrow of the indispensable caudillo, General Porfirio Díaz, after over 30 years in power. Madero would prove much less successful at governance. A litany of missteps and misjudgments, amplified by relentless attacks from a free press that he refused to censor or subsidize, had undermined his popularity and left him vulnerable to the machinations of old guard generals like the ruthless Huerta. In death, however, the apostle of democracy would swiftly become a beloved martyr whose transcendent sacrifice would haunt his successors for decades to come. It was a death foretold by spirits, written in Madero's own hand. On October 30th, 1907, his 34th birthday, Madero channeled a communication from a dead younger brother, Raúl, his spirit guide, or Ángel Guardián, on behalf of a pleiad of superior spirits who in this world have immortalized their names in struggles for the triumph of liberty and justice. Taking temporary possession of his older brother's right arm, Raúl conveyed the hope that, once the struggle was initiated, you will not falter for a single instant and will take as your motto, to be victorious or die. He added ominously that with this resolution firmly rooted, you will always find within yourself the conviction necessary to keep the torch of faith burning. You will always find the strength necessary to fight. You will always have at hand the final recourse, to die valiantly for the cause, to water with your blood the eternal tree of liberty.
Welcome to Revolutionary Spirits, a podcast about revolutions of all kinds and the spirits that shape them. I'm your host, Sam Buffington. This season, we'll be talking about the Mexican Revolution and the life of an improbable revolutionary named Francisco Ignacio Madero. Together with my father, Rob.
Hello, everyone.
A professor emeritus of women and gender studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, we'll explore Madero's remarkable journey from privileged son of one of Mexico's wealthiest families to revolutionary leader, to besieged president, to beloved martyr, and the spirits that accompanied him along the way.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, you should know that this is not a conventional history podcast. First, because conventional history lessons can be a bit predictable, we offer an unfamiliar take on a famous Mexican revolutionary figure, Francisco Madero, focusing on how he incorporated the moral and ethical teachings of a belief system known as Spiritism, conveyed in written messages from spirits he channeled himself, to forge an inspired alternative to the toxic masculine leadership norms of early 20th century Mexico.
Second, because the historical is so often personal, we use the Madero case to ponder the transmission of masculine values across generations in our own family, including the need to come up with alternative ways of being a man.
And third, because the personal is always political, we draw parallels between Madero's revolutionary efforts to transcend toxic modes of masculine leadership and current struggles with distressingly similar issues in the contemporary United States.
We hope you enjoy accompanying us on this historical, personal, political journey as much as we enjoyed taking it together. Before we talk about Francisco Madero, you know, we probably need to understand some of the major events that cemented his legacy, which is, you know, the Mexican Revolution. So what do we need to know about the Mexican Revolution in order to understand the story of Francisco Madero?
Okay, so the Mexican Revolution is really complicated. So that's the first thing to know about the Mexican Revolution. And we'll talk about that later on in the podcast. But one of the things that people don't know about the Mexican Revolution is this is the first major social revolution of the 20th century. Most of the time we think about the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, maybe even the Cuban Revolution, but the Mexican Revolution was the first great social revolution, meaning it was really dramatic changes in Mexican society that come out of this revolution. It's not just a political overthrow. It's what we call a social revolution. It starts in 1910. And we're going to talk about Madero's role in that. It starts in 1910, but by 1911, the Mexican Revolution has managed to oust longtime sort of authoritarian leader Porfirio Díaz. Some people call him a dictator. Some people think he's not quite that bad. Porfirio Díaz has been in power for for over 30 years at this point. He's 80 years old. He's been in power for over 30 years. He's gone, and all of a sudden, things have changed. So then the Mexican Revolution starts, and it's going to last, or at least the initial sort of armed revolution phase of the Mexican Revolution is going to last really from 1910 to about 1920. The destructive costs of this revolution are immense. The deaths are approximately 1.5 million Mexicans die in this revolution. And this is just deaths. This is not people who leave the country. This is not children who aren't born. This is just people who die in the revolution. This is excess deaths. 1.5 million people out of 15 million people. So one in 10 Mexicans dies in this revolution. It happens in different ways, in different times, all over Mexico. Widespread economic and destruction and widespread social disruptions. In addition to being really destructive, it's also a really productive revolution. It develops a new social contract. The Mexican Constitution of 1917 is really... It's at the time, in 1917, when this Constitution comes out, it's far and away the most progressive constitution in the world. It's got minimum wage. It's got publicly funded education. It's got all workers' rights. It's got redistribution of land. It's got all of those kinds of things written into it. This is very different from the U.S. Constitution. It's really clearly a social contract. Subsequent Mexican governments haven't been able to live up to this constitution, but it's always sort of behind the scenes. What we aspire to do is to sort of live up to this amazing constitution. It also produces, and this has a lot to do with the disruption, it also produces a new sense of national identity. There's people's sense before the revolution, many historians argue, for most Mexicans, their loyalties were to the patria chica, the little homeland, you know, the place where they lived, whether it's a town or a state or a region or whatever. That's what, or even their colonia or their barrio, you know, that's where their loyalties lay. After the revolution, there's so much movement of people around Mexico that people really get a sense of being the Mexican nation. So it's both incredibly destructive and incredibly productive at the same time. So we need to know that about the Mexican Revolution.
You know, when I think about the Mexican Revolution, I'm thinking about Zapata. You know, I've got his tattoo, a tattoo of him on my arm. I think about Pancho Villa, you know, the bandoliers and the bullets and, you know, that kind of image. But I know that there were other important figures who were part of the revolution. So kind of who were they and, you know, what were they like?
So we have two different versions here. We've got the sort of outlaw bandits, mm-hmm. and I'm putting that in scare quotes because that doesn't mean that they were.
Right.
This is how they're perceived.
Right, totally.
Like Emiliano Zapata and Pancho Villa. And they're the sort of figures of the revolution that most people relate to.
Right.
Because they're romantic figures and all of those kinds of things. But we also have new elites and modern caudillos or strong men like Venustiano Carranza, who was a former governor of Coahuila, who becomes president. Álvaro Obregón, who's his general, who also becomes president. Plutarco Calles, who's also a former governor, I think of Sonora, who becomes president, who eventually becomes president. And these men also project that sense of sort of masculine leadership,
right,
that people expect. And so one way or another, they fit into
yeah.
that
role. And I feel like it kind of carries over into, you know, the Cuban Revolution too, and figures like Che and Castro.
Absolutely. I mean, we see Fidel Castro, he's usually wearing army fatigues.
Right.
We see Fidel, we see Che, he's got a beret on, he's got long hair. He's that very romantic picture, you know, of Che Guevara. And these are the people we associate with revolution, and especially if we're thinking about Latin American revolutions.
Right. So how does Madero fit into this?
Well, what's interesting about Madero is he doesn't. I mean, he doesn't project that kind of masculine leadership. Now, clearly he's not, or that style of masculine leadership.
Right.
He's clearly not a bandit outlaw, obviously,
right,
in the spirit of Zapata or Villa. But he's also not a sort of traditional strongman in the spirit of Carranza and Obregón and Calles. He's a very different kind of person. Even his grandfather, at the time when he's about to like set in motion the processes that are gonna eventually lead to the overthrow of Porfirio Díaz, says, "Don't do it. This is like a microbe taking on an elephant." And he means Porfirio Díaz, who's
right,
also sort of this mythical figure representing masculine leadership of a certain kind that everyone had sort of come to expect.
So Madero's family played, you know, a major role in his kind of personal and public identity. So what do we know about them? I mean, I've heard they were really wealthy, right?
They were really wealthy. Estimates are that the Madero family was the fifth wealthiest family in Mexico at the time of the Mexican Revolution. So this is an elite family, an elite political elites, economic elites, and they're from Coahuila. So they're norteños. They're from the north of Mexico, and definitely a wealthy family. Not the family you'd expect to produce a revolutionary figure. In other words, there's a grandfather. So Don Evaristo Madero is like the head of this extended patriarchal family. He's got two wives. He's got 18 children. Most of the children are caught up in the family business. But his eldest son is Francisco Ignacio Madero Hernandez, who's going to be Madero's father, right? And he's going to get married. He's got 11 children. So Francisco Madero has 11 siblings. Well, not 11, 10 siblings, right? Right. So this is, again, like an extended patriarchal family. Most of Madero's family, most of Francisco Sr., mm-hmm. most of his family is going to also get involved in the family business. That was certainly the expectation of Francisco Madero González, who's his son, mm-hmm. And who's going to become the presidential figure.
Right. So he had So Madero has a really privileged upbringing, clearly. And, you know, he has the ability to study abroad. I know he goes to Paris and to Berkeley in the United States. You know, so how did that kind of shape him both as a person and as potentially a political leader?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the Madero family was being very strategic here. Mm-hmm. So he's the eldest son of an eldest son, right? So he's in line. You know, it's going to take a while, but he's in line for the patriarchy himself. You know, to be the central patriarch of this family. So they're going to get him educated. So they send him along with some of his uncles, who are the same age as he is, and they send him off with some brothers and uncles to various schools. So he gets sent first to the United States to study at a high school in Maryland. They're not so much concerned that he learn, you know, an academic field, but that he perfect his English.
Right.
So they're sending him off to get that kind of training. That doesn't really, I mean, that's got some mixed benefits. Then they decide, you know, what we really need to do is send him to Paris to study at the School of Advanced Commercial, you know, Studies in Paris, which is like still there, still a world-class institution. This is where elites still send their children, and they decide we need to send Francisco there. So they send him there. They put him in a lycée, which is like a French high school, which is right next to the Palace of Versailles, right? they put him in this high school. He's learning French. He spent 3 years at this school for advanced commercial studies in Paris, comes back to Mexico for a short time, goes off to Berkeley, UC Berkeley, to study agriculture, spends a year in Berkeley and to perfect his English. So they're not concerned about him getting a college degree. So he comes back to Mexico in 1893. He's back in Mexico, back in Coahuila. And he's got this fabulous education, and he enters into the family business and starts, you know, helping expand and modernize and all the things that he's expected to do. So he comes out of his family tradition, you know, up until the early 20th century, he's really following in the footsteps of his father and his grandfather.
Yeah. So he's like really pretty successful at this in his, you know, early mid 20s, something like that. Like,
yes. By the time he's in his late 20s, he's also a wealthy man in his own right. He's doing all kinds of cool experiments. One of the things that he was sort of pioneering was something called guayule, which is a form of cactus that gets turned into rubber. So they were doing those kind of experiments, new kinds of cotton. He writes a plan for a dam to dam up the Nassos River in you know, outside of his hometown so that they can irrigate. So he's like at the cutting edge of all of those kinds of things and super successful.
So we've talked a few times, you know, in this podcast so far about how Madero is an unlikely figure in the Mexican Revolution. And why is it so hard to believe that he could have been such a critical figure in this? What does it say about, you know, the social norms of the time, and even kind of how does that relate to today?
Another good question, because as one level with this education, all of this educational privilege, all of this social, you know, political and economic power that the Madero family represents and that Madero is part of, you would think, well, this guy is a leader. Mm-hmm. A natural leader. But in many other ways that have nothing to do with his sort of social position, his class position, in many of those ways, he doesn't match sort of normative expectations for masculine leadership. Some of this will seem kind of trivial, but at the same time is probably important in terms of masculinity as something that's a public performance, like mm-hmm. who right. is seen to be a leader. He was 5'2", so he's relatively short, right? Mm-hmm. And that's in a country where that's, you know, where 5'2" is not unheard of, but for a Norteño, it's not, you know, mm-hmm. It's not that. He was slight. He wasn't a big guy. He's like, you know, he's just a skinny little guy. He's very well-mannered, you know, mm-hmm. so that's, which is, you know, a sign of good breeding, but not necessarily a sign of masculine leadership,
right.
as we know.
Right.
You know, when people describe him, you know, what he looked like, for some people, he wasn't very attractive looking. You know, when you see him in photographs, he looks fine. You know, he's a nice looking guy, but they always won't comment on his kind eyes. This guy had really kind eyes. He didn't project masculine leadership in that way. people took him seriously because of his social position. People took him seriously because he was, you know, because he was earnest and could, you know, and good at what he was, you know, good at being, you know, an entrepreneur and things.
Right.
So they took him seriously, but he wasn't leadership. He wouldn't have been leadership material in a public, as a public figure.
Well, and especially maybe as like this galvanizing figure, you know, that kind of
right.
heads up a...
Right.
An armed revolt.
Right. I think within his family, he was considered, you know, kind of a headstrong and willful. And they sort of understood some things about his personality, but that wasn't part of his public persona or the way that he presented in public, which I think was less of that. He's going to become, over the course of his political career, he's going to become a very effective public speaker. But when he's giving speeches, he's very sort of energetic and sincere, and he's a good public speaker by the end of his political career, but he doesn't project the kind of masculine authority and strength that Porfirio Diaz did, mm-hmm. even in public appearances. Porfirio Diaz, this is kind of an interesting anecdote, but Porfirio Diaz was probably, you know, 5'8 to 5'10, nobody's quite sure. But when Madero describes him, he describes him as tall.
Right.
Nobody else does, but for Madero, he's a tall figure. So Porfirio Diaz, he wasn't like 6'6", like Venustiano Carranza, but he projected masculine authority in a way that would have been read as a public figure, as being someone who's naturally a leader, you know, very regal bearing, military experience, always stood up straight, always a handsome guy, you know, in that kind of way. And so, mm-hmm.
I feel like some of the things I've heard about Madero were kind of like new agey, but like, wasn't he like maybe a vegetarian and doing yoga or something along those lines?
Yeah, he was definitely engaged in things that we would now associate with, you know, being new agey. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
He was, I think, for on and off vegetarian, but very concerned about eating a proper diet. So very much like, you know, very, very sort of 21st century in this, you know, sort of obsessing about self-care. You've got to have a proper diet. You've got to get exercise. He was also a big exerciser. He was a swimmer. He was a boxer. Like you like to box. He was also an amateur boxer. He did all of those kind of things. But he was also into spiritism, you know. He's into these sort of alternative religions. He was very interested in theosophy, things like that. And so he's new agey in both of his sense of you know, like what you eat, how you act, all the self-care stuff that we do these
right.
days. And then also in terms of his, you know, rethinking ideas about, oh, I don't know, about spirituality and things like that.
So Madero's story to me, you know, it's like about him, obviously, but it's also about like kind of these other, you know, his other family members, his dad, his grandfather, and the kind of the different expectations that those generations carried. I'm thinking back to when you first started telling me this story, and that's when, you know, I started making all of these kind of connections and kind of parallels and contrasts to our family. So, you know, your and I's relationship, but also your relationship to your father, Buff, and my grandfather, Buff, who, you know, and we're like sitting in his house right now, right? We're in his guest house while we're recording this. And just kind of like the things that have gotten passed down and the ways that things have been passed down and the things that haven't. And, you know, so for me, Buff, you know, your dad, my grandfather, just was really this like, growing up, was a very central figure. You know, we've lived with him or like near him more than any of my other grandparents, I feel like, and, you know, stayed with him a lot, was really this kind of central figure and was this like kind of benevolent patriarch, right? Like he, you know, bought us clothes, but also like, you know, shared his interests, right? He had all these interests. He's this guy who's, you know, everybody knows him. We'd go to Mexico and we'd be in Nogales and all the shopkeepers would be like, hey, Buff, come back here. I got something to show you. But like, and you know, he has all these interests. He's a woodworker and a jeweler and
right.
collected rocks and collected everything. Right. And I think that like you know, both of us have like brought some of that with us, but really he held this role as like kind of the patriarch, right?
Yeah.
But I'm kind of curious just how that relationship worked with you and that kind of generational challenges and how that evolved.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think for your generation, you know, for you and your siblings and your cousins, right. My dad was a mythical figure. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just like this, he was like the sort of at the center of things. And when I think about Madero, I'm thinking obviously about Don Evaristo, you know, who's like the one who really pulls it all together for the Madero family. Mm-hmm. And he kind of has that mythical status in the family. So when Francisco is writing to his grandfather, he writes to his grandfather for every birthday. If he can't be there in person, he writes to his grandfather, tells him, yeah, you know, you're just so great. I'm just, you know, just basically, I mean, he's not just sucking up to his grandfather. He's really clearly like sees his grandfather as this mythical figure. So there is that kind of a thing.
Right.
What we don't know in the historical record is how Francisco Madero's father, also named Francisco Madero, related to his father. And that's mm-hmm. the kind of relationship that you're talking about. Those relationships are always, I think, a little more complicated.
Right. You know? Absolutely.
because your father is passing down values that that shape who you are, is sending you signals, because this is a father's job, right? Is sending you these signals about what it means to be a man, how to be a man. As a father, you're helping to shape your son into the man that you hope he's going to be, or the, you know, mm-hmm. and so there's that, and that inevitably creates tensions.
Right.
You know, your grandfather is not trying to shape you as a man. He might be setting an example,
right?
But he's not doing the active shaping. And I think that those kind of tensions, when I think about my life, I'm coming of age. So I'm born in 1952, right? Mm-hmm. I'm coming of age in the late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
The world is just changing around all of us, right?
Right.
Kind of like it is now. You know, it's right. just this crazy time. And my father is really trying to pass on certain kinds of values that come out of his experience as a child of the Depression. You know, he was a baby in the Depression, but it, certainly the Depression played a huge role. His father was, you know, was my grandfather mm-hmm. telling me, you know, when your father was born, I was out plowing a mule. I was out behind, plowing a field behind a mule working for somebody else. So he was right. basically a sharecropper. So I'm out there working, and they had to come get me.
Right.
Just to see to sort of meet my new son. And so he comes out of that experience, and then he's got certain kinds of values. You know, you need to do military service. You need to be in a sports team. He was a good athlete, my father, right?
Yeah.
He was a pitcher in the baseball team, you know, so you need to do that. So he goes, like, well, another anecdote about my dad, right? He's in San Diego. He's a medical corpsman. It's the Korean War. Right. So they're calling up medical corpsmen to go to Korea. They put everybody on a bus. And the way he tells the story, somebody comes and gets him off the bus because he's the pitcher for the team. And they don't want to send him to Korea because they need his services as pitcher. They pull him off the bus. Most of the other medical corpsmen go to Korea and end up getting killed. Wow. So, and I'm a child at this point. I'm his new son, right?
Right.
So this is kind of his experience. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to figure out how to raise me during these troubled times. When we have, as you can really see it with even with Madero and his father, we have really different personalities. You
right.
know, my father was, as you described him, was really outgoing. I'm not that outgoing. I can right. pretend to be, but it takes a toll on me. I'm a classic introvert,
right.
according to Pop Psych, and he's a classic extrovert,
right.
according to Pop Psych. And so those tensions were kind of always present in our lives. And I think there was always tension between the two of us, especially in my coming of age period. They really, you know, by the time I was older, those kind of tensions were dissipating, and
right.
we really had good relationships for most of my, you know, for all of my adult life.
Right.
But we struggled, and that was part of it.
I'm wondering, like, I guess one of the kind of questions that I've always wondered is, like, what was his method for passing down these, like, you know, how to be a good man questions,
Right.
Because I've been thinking about it, and like, you know, because I've got a son, right? I have two sons. But you know, like in how, like finding that balance of like lecturing versus like just trying to be a role model. I feel like from you, I saw a lot more of just like kind of leading by example, or like, you know, passing that on. But I do remember a few times of like actually telling me like real stuff, you know, right. like
don't do that.
Well, yeah, but you know, particularly around, you know, sex and consent and things like that, like having like a real conversation about like, you don't do this, right? Do it this way, not that way.
Right.
Right. And like those like really stuck with me, but I feel like that wasn't the norm. But I'm curious if like, you know, Buff was more of a like, let's give you some lessons, son.
Yeah, he was much more of a, I mean, I think his experience as a son was you know, tough love. Mm-hmm. I mean, my grandfather was a pretty, you know, easygoing guy as I remember him. Mm-hmm. This is like you remember your grandfather, right. Was a pretty easygoing guy. But I think that it was, you know, but he had a barber strap. Mm-hmm. That my father was punished with. And so my father, deciding to be more enlightened, used a ping pong paddle to paddle us.
Right. Right? So,
but it was like that. It was like, right. it was tough love was important, especially for men or mm-hmm. for boys, because they need to, you know, you need to toughen them up so that they can, you know, make their way in the world in the right kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I remember another story about my grandfather and my father that my father would tell about the time my grandfather decides they're living in Colorado, decides to go back to Kansas. He's going to drive. He puts my father, who's like 12 years old, behind the wheel and says, I'm going to take a nap. You drive to Kansas. And he said his father would like wake up every couple hours and go, yeah, okay.
Man.
Yeah. And that was kind of, you know, you kind of sink or swim sort of thing, but also a sense that you needed to be tough with people. Mm-hmm. And then that was reinforced by the culture. So if we were bad, meaning my older sister, she's not older than me, but
the older of your sisters,
the oldest of my sisters, the two of us kind of grew up together. If we were bad, it was like, wait till your father gets home. It was that classic, like late 50s, early 60s kind of, wait till your father gets home. He's going to punish you. And so there's that kind of, so it was a very different kind of experience. And I think that's where a lot of the tension came, was both out of the way he expected to transmit masculine values and the way I received them. And, mm-hmm. and so there's personality involved here, and also just the way values are transmitted. Mm-hmm. You know, to get this back to Madero and the idea about the transmission of values, so embedded in our own family history is a rejection of certain dominant, or what we call in, you know, in gender studies theory, hegemonic forms of masculinity, and the need to develop alternative ways of being a man in response to those. Madero was really, as we talked about earlier, really did struggle with the dominant masculinities of his time. Some of it was just probably, you know, feeling insecure, you know, maybe. Mm-hmm. He wasn't that insecure a person, but feeling a little bit insecure about it. But he was also very sort of cast himself in opposition to the militarized masculinities of strong men like Porfirio Diaz. Mm-hmm. That was part of the problem, was these militarized masculinities. Mexico has just been, you know, ruled by military men, with some exceptions like Benito Juarez, who we hopefully will get to talk about later. But with some exceptions, has been ruled by military men. That's part of the problem. We need to stop that. We need to quit having generals become presidents, because that's not the kind of leadership, masculine leadership, that we need. So that was a problem for Madero. He was also, as a Spiritist, concerned about the amoral materialism of capitalist, you know, hombres de negocio, businessmen, you know, and he thought they were part of the problem too, because they're not looking out. They're not sufficiently altruistic. They're not looking out for other people in Mexican society. We need to do better than that.
Right.
So Madero, like someone like me in the context of my generation, was really had some issues with the way masculinity and masculine leadership was thought about, and was really working hard to come up with alternatives to that.
Right. I mean, I think that's a really interesting point, and one of the things is kind of like stuck with me. And I think it's kind of a parallel to our family, but also, you know, in a little bit of it contrasted with our family. But I do think that, like, you know, one of the pieces that's been there for me is like seeing that because of the time, right? Like that you were talking about coming of age in a revolutionary time, that there's really this like break between the generations. And, you know, and militarism is part of that. I definitely want to like hear your thing about that. But that, you know, from you to me is more, it's like a shift in generations, but it's not that break. And I think that like sometimes that leads to, you know, this is like harder to be clear about who I am or who I want to be as a father, as a man, right? When that shift is where you're not in opposition, right? It's not right into opposition, not only to your role, but also to like kind of society's role. It's like this, not as like clear of a, like, I am not going to be this, or I'm creating something new. So, but yeah, I mean, I know that you were a conscientious objector. And I'm just clear, like, how did that work with Buff, and like, you know, what was that like?
Well, that we're talking about, you know, the Vietnam War, obviously, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The Vietnam War is winding down. My father, was always very patriotic. That was just mm-hmm. part of his family tradition. His father had been a vet. He was a veteran. He took patriotism really seriously. It's the late 50s, right? Mm-hmm. He's a very patriotic guy. It was a struggle for him because he was also paying attention. Like, he knew that this war was not like the other wars. Like, mm-hmm. the Korean War had been pretty problematic, but it didn't last very long.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the Vietnam War was dragging out and dragging out. We're getting into the 60s. It's dragging out some more. He knew there were problems with it, but that didn't mean you got to badmouth America. You know, so you don't get to listen to Country Joe and the Fish, you know, singing the Feeling Like I'm Fixing to Die rag and send my son home in a box kind of stuff. He hated that song.
Right.
And of course he didn't break my record.
Right.
So in that sense, he was like tolerant of it, but it was his expectation. And of course, when I got more and more out of control as a teenager, especially as a young teenager, mm-hmm. you know, one of the options was always military school.
Right.
You know, I'm going to send you to military school if you don't behave yourself. You know, if you can't get your life together, maybe you just need a little bit of discipline. And I'll send you to military school. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. But by the time I was 18, so I was really, you know, I got my draft status and I had to appeal it. I was mm-hmm. 1A. So which means you go.
Right.
If they call you, you go. Right. So I'm 1A. I have to appeal it. And at that point, I'm 18. We've had like, you know, we're getting along much better.
Right.
We're living in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So things are, you know, a little more sort of open. And this sort of the hippie revolution. We're in the middle of a hippie revolution. And he was pretty supportive of me applying as a conscientious objector. So I had to, you know, I had to take my ponytail and shove it down the back of my shirt and pretend I didn't have long hair and go down and meet with the Santa Fe draft board, you know, and convince them by myself. Right. They just like took me into a room and my parents were like, oh, go talk to the Quakers about getting advice about how to do this. So I went down and did it. And then I got conscientious objector status, which was mm-hmm. a miracle. I have no idea why, because most of my friends didn't. But he was at that point, he was supportive of that, but didn't quite understand it, mm-hmm. you know, and that was always, always part of it. But to get to your point about creating yourself in opposition, I think in those really formative years, which would be even before that, like mm-hmm. I'll say the years from, you know, being a 13, 14 year old juvenile delinquent mm-hmm. to being like 16 when I decided to stop taking drugs.
Mm-hmm, right.
in that period, it was really, which was a really formative period.
Right.
Which I came out of okay, fortunately. But then I was able to do what you're talking about, which is like, think of, I am not going to be my father.
Right.
And I'm not gonna be the kind of person he is. We don't share values. He's of the culture, I'm the counterculture mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Right.
So that was kind of in our lives at that particular juncture. And then it showed up again, and this is directly to your point, then it showed up again in raising children. Mm-hmm. And I was really clear. I had a good relationship with my father at this point, and he'd really come around on a lot of things, which is amazing. He never sort of stayed stuck in one place. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd really come around on a lot of stuff, but I knew I was not going to raise my children and especially my sons the way I was raised.
Right.
and so I was really consciously able to, and I think this is what you were talking about, I was consciously able to say, I'm not going to do that. My father did this, I'm going to do this. My father did this other thing, I'm going to do it the opposite way. Your word was clarity. There mm-hmm. was clarity in that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, for me, you know, that like there just wasn't that clarity, right? Like I liked the way I was raised, right? I was like pretty happy with that and wanted to, emulate that. But then at the same time, you know, especially my older son, Victor, you know, was just like, in times he was really struggling with things. And like when we first started thinking about this podcast, right? Like that was definitely a time where he was really having a hard time. And yeah, just feeling like I don't actually know what my like parenting philosophy is, and I don't really know what it's not, you know, I mean, outside of like some really like basic, you know, like I know I don't want to hit him, but, right. but it I always kind of thought that that was just going to come naturally somehow. And when it didn't, what am I trying to do as a parent? And to a certain extent, as a man, when it wasn't just about like, oh, I just want to be like a good person. Right. But like, you know, that there's like a little bit more to that. Like I am a man raising a son, two sons now.
Right.
And what does that mean?
Or sort of a naive belief. And maybe this is what we believed is we were too critical of hippies to really be hippies, but mm-hmm. of that generation. Right. There's that sense that people are going to be naturally good. You know, there's sort of that naivete, you know, of if we just don't mess them up, you know, mm-hmm. if we don't traumatize our kids, they're going to grow up and be great. Mm-hmm. And that the reason that we have issues, I'm talking for myself here, you know, the reason that I have all these, you know, I have different kinds of neuroses is because I was traumatized as a child by my mean father mm-hmm. or by my, you know, negligent mother or something. Right. They weren't either of those things, but still, you know what I mean? That sense of I was traumatized as a child, that's why I'm screwed up. All I have to do is be good. Mm-hmm. It's just like not hit them and be supportive. And they're just automatically going to. Mm-hmm. And then that turns out to be pretty naive too.
Right.
And I think one of the other differences, and this is a lot harder on your generation than mine, is that we just thought all we had to do was, you know, treat you well, and then you would treat other people well, and it was really going to be pretty simple. Mm-hmm. And we were laissez-faire enough that you did things by yourselves and stuff that I don't think parents these days, if they let their kids do that stuff, it has to be deliberate. They need to learn to be independent. So I'm going to let them run around outside in the cactus in Tucson, you know, like you guys got to do.
Right.
Well, we just weren't paying attention.
Right.
You guys have to make a conscious decision. Oh, I think Victor needs to be able to run around in the cactus and he's going to be okay, even though there's rattlesnakes and he can mm-hmm. encounter a coyote or whatever. Right, right, right. It's just going to be okay. We're just like, oh, there, the kid, Sam's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things you're talking about is like that difference in personality. And I think that like, you know, that was something that I was not prepared for. It's just like, not that like that. Even a difference in personality. I think actually Victor and I are really, really similar in personality, but I think that just like, just like the way that he was his own person. Right.
Right.
And that wasn't just, it's more complicated and your personality and your masculinity and to bring it to this podcast, right, is more complicated than just like what you've learned, but is actually like part of who you are.
Absolutely.
And that's going to manifest in different kinds of ways. I mean, I think that like, that's just been something that's like circulating. And I think that this story, and as we get deeper into this, is going to, keep enlightening, but that's like p- part of like this kind of connection back to us and to the current time. And what's part of what makes it so exciting.
Right. Well, in this particular, like in the Madero family, to bring it back to them, you get this interesting shift. And we don't know that much, or at least I don't know that much about Don Evaristo, the grandfather, and Francisco Madero Hernandez, the father. I don't know about tensions in their life. What we do know is that Francisco Madero's father was dabbling in things like spiritism, but in terms of his actual career, he sort of entered the family business, he was like second to Don Evaristo in terms of like patriarchal status. And so he kind of entered the family business and did what he was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And Francisco Jr., he's not junior, but Francisco Madero Gonzalez, mm-hmm. right? The one who becomes president, he's got that relationship with his father up until he enters politics, and especially once he starts to enter oppositional politics at the national level. And then all of a sudden there's this tension, but it's been building. We're going to talk a lot more about spiritism, but that plays a role in the way that he sees spiritism, which is different from his father.
Right.
But unlike, you know, my relationship with my father, which was crazy times, and by the time I was 18, it was clear I was not going to be my father.
Right.
Right. You know, I hadn't done sports. I hadn't joined the military. You know, I was, you know, clearly a very different kind of person. And he'd gotten used to that. And we'd gotten used to each other. For Madero, it's more like what you're talking about. It's just like all of a sudden things aren't quite happening and I need to make some changes. And so that's, mm-hmm. so with him, it's also, and it doesn't happen until he's in his 20s.
Yeah. That kind of leads me to kind of a segue, I guess, into the other thing that I think is just really interesting about this story is, you know, like just thinking about the times of the Mexican Revolution. So the revolution itself, but even more the like kind of lead up to it and this like idea, you know, probably worldwide, but particularly in Mexico, and just like how some of those things relate to what's happening now, like in our kind of current time.
Yeah.
And so this kind of, and like both like, so to our current time, to the time that you're coming of age, right? This like kind of hippie revolution that we've talked about, and then the Mexican Revolution. So like those kind of like three pieces. And, you know, just kind of this idea of like an emerging consciousness or like a changing consciousness that is thinking about democracies and the challenges to democracy, and kind of this rejection of authoritarianism, but also like they're like, I mean, we're on that cusp, right? Like, there's like, it's right there.
Right.
So, and I think that, I'd just be curious about some of your thoughts too, on like kind of just like where are these?
Well, I think one of the obvious parallels, to do parallels first, mm-hmm. one of the obvious parallels is that the Porfirian regime, Porfirio Diaz's regime, right, was a gerontocracy. This is a regime of old men. Like Porfirio Diaz is over 30 years in power.
Right. But
when he starts, he's a middle-aged man. He's a war hero, all those kinds of things from the, you know, anyway, we don't need to get into Porfirio Diaz's history. But by the time Madero takes him on, he's approaching 70. Most of the governors in Mexico of states are in their, you know, 70s and 80s. Most of his ministers are in there. These guys will not get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that sense of old men mm-hmm. who will not get out of the way. And I think we all feel, you know, even if we want to like be supportive of someone like Joe Biden, if we want to be supportive of, we don't want to be supportive of Mitch McConnell, but you know,
no.
if we want to be supportive, I mean, now that I'm older, right?
Right.
Now that I'm approaching 70, I'm thinking about, okay, you know, maybe like respect for your elders. And I have all this wisdom that I need to be sharing, but old men need to get out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, and I think there's, that's yep. really a very clear parallel, and it's, and it really is. I mean, there's exceptions like Nancy Pelosi, but it really is mostly men, and it's a mm-hmm. certain kind. And part of the problem is not just men. It's a certain kind of masculine leadership, even when they're being benevolent, like Joe mm-hmm. Biden. You know, it's still that benevolent kind of masculinity. I'm going to protect you. You just need to believe in me. I'm going to do good things for you. I'm mm-hmm. your grandfather. Here's some Christmas presents. You know, it's that kind of thing. And I think that was true of Mexico. And with Madero, you can really sense that his coming to consciousness is a frustration with these like aging patriarchs. Mm-hmm. And we can talk a little bit later about a letter he writes. He goes to meet Porfirio Diaz, right? Yeah. And he writes a letter back to his mother. He doesn't send the letter to his father. He says, I met with this guy. He's a doddering fool.
Wow.
And I am encouraged. I mean, and he in his book, he's actually much nicer to Porfirio Diaz than that. You know, he's too egotistical. He's too militaristic, but he's a good man. Right. And this one, he's like, no, Porfirio Diaz is a doddering fool. He's not nearly as aware of things as my grandfather, Evaristo.
Right.
Who is, even though Evaristo is ailing,
right.
You know, so it's like, it's pretty clear that Madero's in his 30s at this point, in his mid to early 30s, right? early to mid 30s, sorry. And he's frustrated. Right. These guys will not get out of the way.
Right.
And we need something new in Mexico, and they won't get out of the way, and their values won't get out of the way.
Yeah. And it seems like, wasn't there some like, you know, some like kind of failed reforms that happened like right before all of this happens? Cause like, that's also, you know, living in Minneapolis, this thing that's like very present in my mind right now. But
yeah, for Madero, that's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll talk about this in one of the later episodes, but there's this moment when it seems like Porfirio Diaz might not run for president again.
Right.
He would be like for the seventh time that he might not run for president again, and that he might appoint somebody, you know, that there might be some other candidates who are younger. There's this sense that the Porfirian regime is going to, you know, improve things. They're doing education reforms. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the Porfirian capitalist model is trickle down, mm-hmm. right? As long as we can maintain order, capitalist development will happen. And once that happens, then the fruits of capitalist development will trickle down to the people of Mexico. Right. And the trickle down is just drip. It's like Chinese water torture. Drip, 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 right?
Yeah.
And so Madero is frustrated. He really believes in economic reform. He believes in what he would call moralizing the working class, which he felt was being really abused. Mm-hmm. And he acted on those things in a sort of individual, you know, this sort of neoliberal moment. It's like, okay, what can I do? And so Francisco Madero opens a public, you know, a public dining room mm-hmm. and starts feeding people. What can I do? He learns how to become a homeopathic doctor and opens a clinic for his for his peons, right? His peones, right? And so what can I do? And he's doing all of these things. And then at some point in the early 1900s, around 1903, it's not enough. We need political change.
Right.
And that's where he is by 1903 and 1904. Right. And then by 1910, he's going to be, we need a revolution.
Right. But I just think that like that idea, right, of that moment of like, well, we tried this thing. Like we thought that there was going to be some change.
Yeah.
Right. We thought that like, oh, well, maybe things can actually happen. And I think that that's, you know, like right now, obviously, you know, the Minneapolis police murdered George Floyd, right? And like after that, there was this real surge of like feeling of like, well, we don't need the police, right? There was like major unrest after that, right? And then there was this feeling of like, well, like, and something else could happen. There could be a different vision and we could start this idea of defunding the police. And, you know, in this last election, we realized that didn't happen, right? Like, and there were some positive things that came out of it, but the major, you know, we reelected the mayor and some of those things that were like the opposition to that.
Right.
And that feeling of like these reforms didn't quite happen.
Well, reform is tough. I mean, in Mexico, you get a miner strike in Cananea, which is in northern Mexico, right? And Diaz puts it down ruthlessly. You also get strikes around the country that Diaz ruthlessly suppresses. And everybody thinks, okay, that's the sign we need to do something. Reforms are surely going to come.
Right.
You know, in response to this, like and it's pretty clear what the regime's responses are. Now we need to do something. A sense of urgency is there, like it was with George Floyd. Right. There's a sense of we need to do something. And it's, and Madero feels it, that Porfirio Diaz's response is, we need more of me.
Thanks for tuning into the first episode of Revolutionary Spirits. Next time, we'll pick up Madero's story as he moves from a privileged son of the Mexican upper class to a politician fighting for democracy, all guided by the spirit of a dead baby brother.
Before we go, we have some very important folks to thank. Our amazing producer, Steven Renderos, the wonderfully supportive Center for Humanities and the Arts at the University of Colorado Boulder, several terrific historians, especially Manuel Guerra Luna, Enrique Krause, C.M. Mayo, Roberto Narvaez, Alejandro Rosas, Ignacio Solares, and Yolia Tortolero Cervantes. And last but never least, a special thanks to all of you for listening to Revolutionary Spirits.